There's a cross appeal here. Have counsel agreed on an order of presentation for the case?
Your Honor, we're happy to go as the cross appellant. We're happy to go second. I don't think we'd be here for putting this initial appeal. So.
All right, then we'll proceed with the appellant going first. Counsel is ready. You may proceed.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Sean McCarthy, M-A-C, capital C-A-R-T-H-Y, on behalf of the appellant, the plaintiffs. In this case, my bar number is 09-PHV-2081. And along with me at counsel table is Mr. Andrew Peterson from Wood, Riss, and Hames. And good afternoon, counsel. Your Honors, this case is a case about conduct of the defendants, which Judge Jackson described at one point as borderline outrageous. And we are asking this court to decide that Judge Jackson was erroneous in determining that the defendants did not breach the contract, namely the contract that my clients had from 2002 with a company called Connection. And we're asking that particularly this court note that the only reason Judge Jackson found that there was no breach of contract was because he erroneously determined that my clients did not give consent with respect to the software that they had developed transferring over to the defendants, Azure.
Written consent.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Written consent, correct. All right, because the contract required written consent for it to be assigned. And we reviewed that finding by the district court for clear error. Is that correct?
I would argue, Your Honor, that the specific finding in this case that the judge made that there was no written consent should be reviewed de novo, because that is the inherent finding the court made with respect to the breach of contract, which should be reviewed de novo.
The question of breach of contract ultimately is also a factual question in Colorado, subject to review for clear error, as opposed to, say, interpretation of a contract. The question whether the contract's been breached is a factual question.
Well, we've cited case law to the effect that the determination as to whether or not there was a breach of contract is a matter of law which should be reviewed de novo. But in any event, what I intend to do this afternoon is go through and talk about basically two main issues. One is going to be the intent with respect to the asset purchase agreement from 2004, and then I'm going to talk about the issue of consent. Before I do that, I want to make one thing clear regarding Subex, which is the company that now is the, as Judge Jackson put it, the company which is buying the drinks at the end of the day. And I want to make this clear. Subex merged with Azure in June of 2006. And in pretrial proceedings and during this trial, there seemed to be this air of, oh, poor Subex. And I want to make sure that we're all on the same page that this is not about Subex and what they did or didn't do with respect to a contract with a company called Connection in 2004. Subex had nothing to do with that. But any issue regarding oh, poor Subex is only relevant, if at all, with respect to the defense raised here concerning latches, which, depending on how much time I have, I can address those issues. But I want to be clear about that, because when you read this transcript and you read Judge Jackson's findings, there's almost this underlying tone that he was somehow inclined to find that he wasn't going to award the $2.4 million in accelerated damages, even though he clearly said that, well, he didn't clearly say, but he implied that the acceleration clause would apply if there was a breach of contract. But at the same time, he kind of appeared to buy into this oh, poor Subex argument. And I want to submit to this court that from the opening statement in this case, the defendant, Subex, Azure, acknowledged during their opening statement that if Azure breached the contract, Subex is responsible for that breach. So I want to make that clear from the get-go. And now I want to talk about the intent of the parties, namely the intent of Azure in 2004, when they assumed the contract that was entered into between my clients and Connection back in 2002.
And relevant if the contract is clear? You're going to talk about the parole evidence rule, and we have a contract in front of us that's unambiguous and clear?
Your Honor, I think that's an excellent question, and I can answer by telling you this. When we went to try this case, obviously both parties had filed motions for summary judgment, and Judge Jackson invited the parties to offer parole evidence in this case. But before trial, I think both parties maybe were a little bit confused about that. I would submit to this court that some of the language, which we're going to talk about today, and some of the language which is cited in the brief, may well be unambiguous. But that being said, Judge Jackson specifically asked for parole evidence because he wanted to know what the intent of the parties was with respect to whether or not Azure assumed this contract.
But at the end of the day, what he found was the lack of written consent precluded a claim under the contract. So he didn't really rely on the parole evidence one way or the other. So I'm not sure what you want us to do with that parole evidence.
Well, the parole evidence is relevant, and I'll get to consent, but the parole evidence is relevant because during trial, it was established that prior to November 1st of 2004, this company, Connection, had discussed the potential merger with Azure.
Let me interrupt again. I'm sorry, Mr. McCarthy. Let's assume the contract did include the asset of the TCS software, and let's assume that it did include the liability that was associated with that. Still, even if the intent or the purpose or the language of the contract was to include it, you don't disagree that it still required the consents that Judge Jackson found were missing, do you? In other words, in the absence of consent, it doesn't make any difference, does it?
Well, we have two arguments as to even if we didn't get consent, why they're still responsible. But no, I would assert that if this particular contract, to answer your question, said that we take the position it did say it, but if it clearly or more clearly than it does said that we assume this contract, under Colorado law regarding successor liability, if there's an express assumption of a contract, I would argue that they did assume the contract.
Well, we assume the liabilities subject to being provided with the express consents that are specifically provided for in 2.05A. Absent those consents, you can go to 2.05B or C. I understand that's your alternative argument. But I'm saying Judge Jackson obviously figured out during the trial, or at least wrote in his order, I don't have to decide if it was an excluded liability or included liability, because in the absence of written consent, it doesn't make any difference. And that seems to me that's the decision that we're faced with. Well, did he err, and you started that way, did he err in finding consent? We can assume it was an included liability, but in the absence of consent, it doesn't help. It doesn't get you anywhere.
We clearly take the position that there was consent, but I would argue that under Colorado law, that for two reasons, even if you find that there was no consent, the problem is that what this really amounted to was this amounted to a merger. And as I read Colorado law from the Alcon case, if there is a merger, that is one of the four exceptions to the non-liability of, you know, under an asset purchase agreement.
Did you file an amended complaint in this case?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Did you file an amended complaint for the plaintiffs?
We did not.
Well, I read the complaint a few minutes ago, and I see nothing in there that alleges that this was a merger. I see it alleges that this was a mere continuation, but I don't see that it alleged it was a merger. I also saw that alleged that what Azure acquired were assets, not a company. That's what I found in your complaint, and I was wondering if there was an amended complaint that changed that.
We have not filed an amended complaint, but we certainly have argued on appeal that these facts and the clear intention of the parties ultimately resulted in a merger. So there are two grounds here for the successor liability. One would be the assumption, and two would be the merger.
You argued on appeal. I don't dispute that. I saw it in your brief. That's why I looked in the complaint to see if it was pled as a merger, and I didn't see that it was pled as a merger.
But we pled successor liability.
I agree. I agree, using the words mere continuation, successor liability as a subheading in your complaint, but not using the words merger.
I would assert that we properly pled any area of successful liability under Colorado law, which would include assumption and merger. And I would concede, as I'm standing here right now, that the weakest argument we have regarding successor liability would be the mere continuation, simply because the shareholders of Connection did not become shareholders of the London LTD. And I will concede that. But I think the stronger arguments are clearly the assumption and then the merger. But
Mr. McCarthy, I want to get back to this issue of consent, because I'm troubled by the fact that complaint expressly alleges that your clients did not consent. And I understand that parties are allowed to plead in the alternative, but this is the way it usually works. We contend A, but if you find that A is improved, we still win because of B. That's how you plead in the alternative. You don't say, we contend A, and we contend not A. But that's what you're trying to do right now.
Here's the difference, Your Honor, and I appreciate the questions, and I have two responses. Number one, I would respectfully ask this court to look at the default judgment order which was entered against Connection. And this was negotiated between the parties in this case, and it's in the record at page 2887. And what that order specifically says is that default, which we obtained against Connection, as Your Honor points out, because before the November 1st deal was done, we obviously had no opportunity to consent to that deal because we didn't know about it, okay? So when we got the default judgment against Connection based on the lack of consent, both parties in this case came in front of the judge and said, we want this language. The language is this: the judgment against Connection shall have no preclusive or mitigating effect on the plaintiff's claims against the remaining defendants or on defendants' claims and defenses against the plaintiffs. So I think that's an important point here, Your Honor. And that is to say that when this default judgment was entered against Connection, we both agreed that that doesn't mean we can run in and say, oh, we got you now, we got you for $3 million, nor does it mean that they can somehow do what they're attempting to do now and what Judge Jackson did, with all due respect, when he said that somehow that our theory of breach of contract against a prior company, which was left as a shell corporation, is somehow going to bar our claim.
So I think it's not a question of what the default order provides. It's a question of what you pled. You pled that there was no consent. And now you come back after the fact, I mean, after you get that judgment, and then you want to come in against a different party and say, we did consent. I mean, that to me, again, doesn't strike me as pleading in the alternative. It strikes me as trying to have things both ways, which is not what pleading in the alternative is all about.
Isn't it a judicial admission, I think, is what Judge Jones is asking?
Yeah. Why isn't it? Aside from the default judgment order, aside from that, it's in your pleading.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
There were inconsistent pleadings, and Judge Jackson pointed this out on both sides in this case. And Judge Jackson pointed out that our pleadings in this case, you know, you don't elevate form over substance. And we have put on evidence in this case that was entirely consistent with a timeline of consent, which is clear now. And Judge Jackson simply missed it. We didn't consent to Connection, but our consent to Azure was clear on its face in that the emails and the exchanges that went on for months and months and months, they demonstrated that consent. And Mr. Bruni testified that when he got the December 13th, 2004 email, he specifically acknowledged that he took that to mean that allowed him to keep the software. And I don't need to tell Your Honors that obviously the payment was made in January. So the consent itself was given. And as Judge Jackson pointed out, the pleadings in this case, although they may have been somewhat inconsistent, the operation of law should not bar us from claiming that we had consent.
Are you saying consent was not given for Connection to transfer or assign, but consent was given for Azure to take the assignment?
There's no question that we're saying that we didn't give consent to Connection because we didn't know about it, and that's why we sued them. But the timeline is clear that once we got wind of this deal between Connection and Azure, we reached out, we asked them, what's the deal? And they said, through their president, and they're trying to claim now he doesn't have authority, which is ridiculous. He was the president of the company, and we've shown documents as to why he had specific authority, and they try and claim that it was left out. Well, yeah, our position is clear that we did give consent to Azure from the fall through approximately February of 2005.
Based on the three emails that each of the plaintiffs sent.
based on the emails. Based on the three emails.
Right. None of which use the word consent in them.
They don't use the word consent, but I will point this out, Your Honor. If you look at the defendant's reply brief in this case, the defendant's reply brief actually on page page two of the reply brief, the defendants in this case on page two characterize what happened from November through December, January 2005. They characterize it as whether plaintiffs would consent to such assignment. I mean, it's clear what was going on was that they knew they had our consent. That's why they made the payments. And they're the ones that said, we are going to give you an assignment. Not that it's needed, but we're going to give it to you and it's done. And they told us that three different times. So that is our position regarding consent. But moreover, even if we didn't give consent, as Judge Richman pointed out, under 205 B and C, they were obligated to do certain things, and they took this liability under 205C.
Who was obligated?
I'm sorry, Azure was obligated under 205C to pay.
Doesn't it say that the seller was obligated under 205C, the seller being Connections, to make reasonable efforts to obtain the consent, and the seller was responsible for putting in effect a program to get the consent?
My time is up. May I answer your question, Judge Richman?
Yeah, you may, and I'm going to ask one more afterwards. Okay.
Sure. No, it doesn't say that. It does say that, but in addition, it says that Azure is responsible for obtaining consent, and moreover, under C, what it says is that if there's no consent, then they take the asset. They have to make payments on it. They have to pay the liability on it under 205C.
I know you have another question, Judge Richman, but I want to follow up on this because that provision 205 B and C, those are obligations between the seller and the buyer, Connection and Azure. So how do you piggyback on those? I mean, maybe Azure has an action against Connection for not doing what it was supposed to do, but how does that give your clients any rights?
I've tried to do my best to understand Colorado case law on that issue. And I don't think it's a close call. The defendant is attempting to use that against us under A to say that we didn't give consent, therefore it applies against us. Clearly, we were an intended beneficiary of 205 B and C because what they're saying there is if there's a restricted asset, which is what this became, then they're obligated to pay for it. And that's what 205C says. That's exactly what it says.
And last question is more fundamental. In your relief, request for relief, all you ask for is us to vacate the judgment, reverse, and enter judgment on behalf of your clients. Do I take that to mean you are not asking us to order a new trial in the event we agree with any of your positions?
I believe that we certainly are asking this court to reverse regarding the breach of contract and to award damages based on the $2.4 million accelerated. If this court does not find that there's a breach of contract, I believe that we're asking under the unjust enrichment to have them do what they should have done during the case, which is to honestly produce documents and answer interrogatories. And that's what we're asking under unjust enrichment.
Are you asking for a new trial on the unjust enrichment damages? Because I don't think those words appear in terms of your relief request.
But my request with respect to unjust enrichment, assuming you didn't do the contract, would be to order as a matter of law that under unjust enrichment, the trial court borrowed the share purchase agreement with the 10%, 5%. So I would ask you to say that under unjust enrichment, the true damages are $2.4 million accelerated. If you don't find that, then I would ask you to send the case back to the trial court to have an honest determination as to the revenues that were generated by the products that they stole from us.
I think we would call a new trial just as to the damages on unjust enrichment.
Correct.
That's right. Okay.
But I still know my first argument is you don't need that because
I understand. I just want to know what you're asking for because I didn't find it in your brief.
Okay.
You should know, Mr. McCarthy.
I apologize.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Good afternoon. My name is Eric Elliff, E-L-L-I-F-F. My bar number is 16844. Your Honors, Mr. McCarthy started off talking about how my client, Subex, is not impacted by this case at all. And I would like to simply point out that had any of the plaintiffs, but most specifically Mr. Ivett, told Subex at the time, pre-merger, about his claim, then my client, Subex, could have made appropriate provisions in the merger agreement with Azure, accounted for the claim in an escrow agreement, and we wouldn't be here today. But Mr. Ibbot did not do that. He stayed silent. He intentionally, consciously stayed silent. The merger closed. My client, Subex, acted to its detriment. And 2 years later, the plaintiffs finally bring their action against Subex. That's class latches.
Mr. Ellis, is that how you pronounce it?
Yes.
What is the standard of review of the issue of latches?
I believe it's abuse of discretion as a matter of equity at the trial court. It's reviewed under an abuse of discretion standard.
So what is your basis for contending that Judge Jackson didn't consider adequately all of the factors here? I mean, I know you disagree with his articulation of those factors, but he did discuss at length that he thought that Mr. Ibbots was at fault and that Azure was at fault also.
That's right, Your Honor. And it is simply this. Judge Jackson did not articulate in his opinion the precise test for latches that is set forth in Colorado case law. He appeared in his decision to simply balance the equities of the unjust enrichment arguments that the plaintiffs were making against the latches arguments that my client was making. And I don't think that is technically a precise and correct application of the test. So I think under that measure, it's an abuse of discretion. But I think our position on latches is fully set forth in the brief, and I don't want to belabor latches. But I did want to clear the air of any misconception that my client is something other than an innocent actor.
Mr. Ellis, if you don't dispute that Azure was merged into Subex,
I do not.
That's one merger we agree on.
Right.
Once Azure was merged into Subex, Subex became responsible for Azure's liabilities, correct?
Correct.
So if the plaintiffs had a right to claim against Azure, Subex took it over by virtue of the merger, right? So the problem is Mr. Ibbots didn't tell, or Azure didn't tell, Subex about the pending claims against it.
Yes.
So Subex has claims back against, presumably against Azure, for non-disclosure.
If
but as a matter of law, they're responsible for Azure's debts one way or the other. So latches, I don't see how latches makes a difference here.
Well, latches makes a difference because you have to go back to the situation as it was pre-merger. During the time that Subex was conducting due diligence at Azure.
And Azure concealed the material fact.
Well, Azure and Mr. Ibbot concealed the material fact. That's
so you have a claim. So you have a claim against them, but I guess I really don't see how it fits a classic latches pattern is my problem.
Well,
given the fact that they merged. They didn't buy something from them, they merged with them.
They didn't merge, they did merge, but our point simply is within the merger documents, they could have accounted for Mr. Ibbot's claim had Mr. Ibbot told them. He didn't tell them, he delayed, the merger closed. Subex acted to the detriment. I'd like to go back to the main case, appellant's case, and talk about Judge Jackson's main findings, and that is specifically no written consent. Now, there's written consent required under two separate contracts. The first contract, what we've been calling the share purchase agreement, by which Connection acquired TCS, plaintiff's company. That document clearly requires a written consent prior to assignment. There was no written consent here. Judge Jackson so found. That is a clear error standard. It's a question of fact. Colorado law is clear on that.
Mr. Ellis, would you agree, though, that I know that the parties were talking about doing some kind of a formal assignment document, but that we can have a written consent by virtue of emails?
I think we can have a written consent by virtue of emails, and if any of the emails in evidence of this case reflected written consent, perhaps the appellants would have something to their argument. But it clearly didn't. If you look at the email exchange that took place, what was going on is plaintiffs became aware of the connection asset acquisition. And plaintiffs started asking questions, what's going on with our agreement? And the emails back and forth reflect a very pointed concern on the part of the plaintiffs that their agreement wasn't actually transferred. They kept asking the question, but they testified that they were concerned about that. So not only was there not written consent as required under not only the TCS agreement, but also, by the way, the asset purchase agreement under Section 2.05. Not only was there not written consent, plaintiffs were concerned about that very point. And in fact, their concerns came to prove prescient when they were told in February of 2005, just a couple of months after these email exchanges started, that it was Azure's position that this agreement had not been acquired in the asset acquisition, was not one of the assets acquired. So, and 2.05 speaks to that. It specifically excludes assets that require a written consent, and there was no written consent here. So 2.05 talks about what's supposed to happen in that case, and in that case, it is the seller connection that has to go get the written consent. And I heard during counsel's oral argument that Connection was a shell company. In fact, after the asset purchase by Azure, Connection was left with a substantial number of assets, and indeed assets, the record shows, that comprised over 50% of its revenue. So Connection was anything but a shell company at that point. Connection had assets, which it sold a couple of months later, leaving, I think we would all agree, nothing but a shell. But up until that point, there were actually assets, and they were assets that the plaintiffs could have gone after and should have gone after.
Let me ask you about an argument that the plaintiffs made, but I didn't get a chance to ask Mr. McCarthy about. He suggests that under Colorado law, the weight of giving a consent is solely with the person whose consent is required. In other words, they can waive their right to give consent under a case called Fink versus Montgomery Elevator. I think if it's backwards, probably Montgomery Elevator versus Fink. What do you say about that? He says the Colorado law says the consent's for the protection of the consentor, not the consentee, so to speak.
I think 2 points on that, Your Honor. I think that's an overstatement of Colorado law, and Fink is the case that I like to point to show that. In Fink, the person objecting to the consent was not either party to the contract. The person objecting to the consent was a third party who, I don't quite remember the facts, but was somehow obligated to it was Montgomery Elevator, they were obligated to repair the elevators or something, and they were involved as a third party. But it was the third party, because they weren't getting paid or something, that was objecting to the assignment. The two parties to the contract, I think, there was no objection. So, and the other...
Well, Connections isn't objecting here, I don't think. I mean, they defaulted.
Right. Well, okay. That's right. That's right.
And they were the party that bargained for consent. Are you suggesting that Azure also bargained for consent? Is that really what you're saying to us?
I'm saying that's right. And what the Azure Connection Asset Purchase Agreement says under 2.05 is if there is a written consent required, pursuant to our asset purchase, you, seller, have to go get that consent. And that makes sense. That's my understanding. I'm a litigator, what I know, but that's a common provision in asset purchase agreements, because what they don't want to have happen, what the buyers want to have happen, is to be taken by surprise when somebody like the plaintiffs, TCS, says, this was assigned without consent.
And so the Fink case is distinguished because here there's two levels of consent. One is Connections was required to get their consent, and then Azure required Connections to get their consent.
Exactly right.
And that's different factual pattern from
Fink.
Yes,
very different.
Okay.
Fink, only one contract in Fink. Two contracts here both requiring written consent. Your Honors, I would suggest that absent written consent, there is no clear error in that finding. Absent written consent, what plaintiffs are left with is an unjust enrichment cause of action. And plaintiffs are here in part appealing what is now a judgment that is in excess of $500,000 with pre-judgment interest, post-judgment interest. The award that Judge Jackson awarded the plaintiffs was $320,000 with interest retrospective and then, of course, interest going forward. Their position is that they are entitled to an entire $2.5 million amount, which they characterize as an accelerated amount. But it's important, and it's very clear in the TCS agreement. The $2.5 million was an earn-out provision. That is, if software was sold, the plaintiffs were entitled to a percentage. The more software that was sold, the better for the plaintiffs because the more money they got.
Well, the obligation was going to be evidenced by notes.
Yes.
Plaintiff gave me the impression that these notes were actually issued and it was just a matter of sending the notes to Connections to get them collected. Were these notes actually issued by Connections?
They were indeed.
So there were notes that totaled $2.5 million?
No. Okay. That's the critical distinction, and pardon me for interrupting.
No, thank you.
That's the critical distinction. The notes were only issued after a quarter of software sales. So what would happen is the software would be sold January through March. They'd look back and they'd say, how much software was sold? X thousands of dollars.
There wasn't a series of notes that totaled $2.5 million that Connection issued that they could call in the event of a default.
True.
Okay, that never happened.
Exactly right. The only notes that ever issued were notes that were issued looking back at the sales from the prior quarter.
Okay.
And so the note agreement, the TCS share purchase agreement, all of those contemplate earnout, not a $2.5 million windfall. There's no liquidated damages provision in there. There's no provision which says, Judge Richman, in the event of a default, all of the notes will issue and all will be immediately callable. There's no provision like
that. How is it then that in the default judgment against Connection that was awarded as damages? I mean, the full default amount, because even in a default, the plaintiff has to prove the amount of damages.
Well, and what the Connection was and is unrepresented. And so what the plaintiffs did is they based it on the $2.5 million earn-out provision and requested that amount, and that amount was granted. I think that's a wrong reading, but that was for Connection to argue, not Subex.
Given that fact, the statement that Connection had no, that they did not give consent to Connection justifying this default judgment, a judicial admission?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Was there pleading that they did not give consent to Connections, a judicial admission by the plaintiffs?
Oh, I think so, Your Honor. Yes, absolutely. It has been there.
Why didn't you argue that then?
Well, retrospect, Your Honor, hindsight is a great clarifier.
Mr. Ellick, how could it be a judicial admission if a judicial admission is a declarative, unequivocal statement, and the plaintiffs apparently changed their position? So I would think it wasn't an unequivocal statement.
It was unequivocal almost up to the eve of trial.
Right, but then they changed their position.
They did change their position, but by that time they had obtained a default judgment against Connection on the basis of a breach of contract claim, which said, you, Connection, breached our contract because we did not consent. It's the whole basis. That was the whole basis of that.
I understand that.
So to get back to the unjust enrichment theory, what they were entitled to at the end of the day was sort of the benefit of their bargain. That is, the amount of money based on the software that was sold. The only evidence on that point was presented by the plaintiffs, and certainly Judge Jack. It was evidence sufficient that Judge Jackson could issue the award. I am out of time. If Your Honors have other questions, I'm happy to hear.
Thank you, Counsel. to both counsel for your arguments today. The case will stand submitted. We are finished with the only two cases on the docket, so the court will stand in recess. The bailiff may so announce.